Every beginning is just a sequel. I like that. So this is a sequel. And it's Gemeinschaftsonnenwald. It means sun forest community. I like to get my sister in the room when I start reading these days. I used to have four of them, and now I've got three. Mary died soon after her 50th birthday, and she's the happiest one in my family. So I like to get that happy spirit in here. The middle of this book. Can you hear me back there?
Can you close the door?
Well, okay. I will if we don't get too hot. And if we get if we get hot, then it'll I'll start
okay.
shouting.
The air conditioning will kick on probably.
My first stop on this tour was a poetry get together in Shelbyville, Kentucky. It was dominated by tavern shouters. So, and actually, you know, I cut my teeth in places like Red Sky or readings at the Comet Tavern, so I'm used to out shouting drunks. But many of you probably don't have a lot of experience with poetry reading, so I want to tell you what it's not. It's not a chamber music concert where you have to sit on your hands and be afraid of.
What?
Yeah. My God. If you like something, you know, if you want to laugh, laugh. If you want to clap, clap. If you want to shout, shut up, don't do that. But the point of a poetry reading is to bring the poems alive. Most of us were messed up by high school teachers who taught us that poetry was a serious enterprise which contained a code which you as a young person did not understand. And if you paid attention, that teacher would let you know what was actually being said. That is what poets call bullshit. The words are a space between us. I paid a lot of attention putting them on paper, and the more attention you pay listening to them, the more magic arises between us. And that's where the poem lives, in the space between. This is called Invocation for Mary Joanne Thomas Martinson. It sure is good to see you. All of you. But I mean, it's wonderful to be here in your presence. Spaces between the stars are crowded with stars. Starlight everywhere. Only our eyes are not large. I turn where I see no light and raise my voice to you there. Generous mother, joyous girl, vivid woman. Come. Come out of the seeming night, out of the darkest space, there where silence and death seem to foreclose life and light. Come back to me here, where I crouch, befuddled, a fool at court in the kingdom of speed and noise. There are terrors here, and worse than those that as children we knew. Then it was Dad and the bomb. Now, it's the end of time. That's how it feels to me now, in this, the warmest December since anyone can remember. Snow-capped mountains are few. Upon a time once was a plan. The God of our innocence had everything in his mind. But the plan was written in smoke. It was gone with a wave of a hand, replaced, as I hear it now, with what was always there, the improvisations of love. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. The poem, at least in my case, always begins as an improvisation. It's me improvising on my axe, which is a pen. But luckily, it doesn't have to stay there with all the intrusions of my ego. I can go out and I can refine it. But it always starts out as an improvisation. And the act of revision is the act of getting down to the basic melody and the basic rhythm and cutting out all the stuff that's distraction. So I want to read you a poem about improvisation. It's strictly. I'm wondering which one it's going to be. This one. This is called imaginary number. Picture this. Mingus and Davis together. Evans at the piano. Their conversation is not in any way mellow. Can you hear them? Trawling the depths of their rage, configuring ambition. Lips, ears, fingertips, and the intimacy of their axes in the presence of the hip and their hangers-on. We weren't there, but we are here, word to word, with the line breaks and the syllable boundaries, fingering the air with what we know of America and all that it has refused to become. Take me out a step farther. We can leave chronology out without losing time. Bring in Django, LaVon Helm on the drums, Bach J.S. on the Hammond 8. Can we officiate here in this club at the marriage of race and invention? The skirmishes of ego abound in the night spots of Jerusalem and Sarajevo. Can we let new worlds unfold to acknowledge the broken lives and the shattered hopes out of which these musics have risen? As if to bring us, wave-like, a world in the present tense, its leading edge, breaking. I'm going to do the other improv poem from this. This book is arranged in five parts, and it's got an introductory little poem that goes like this. I've been writing poems for 60 years or so. Most of the poems died of ideation, others of sentiment. The ones in which thought and feeling dance have life for now. And each of the sections itself has a little proem, and this second section is called Who is Who? And I'll tell you why. You may not be able to recall Walt Whitman, bring up to mind his Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. But he makes an outrageous claim in this poem. He says, you up there, and so I'm reading, you up there. You talking to me? He says, I foresaw you. Yes, I mean you. You mean more to me than you know. That's what I'm referring to here. And also to Emily, when I say Emily, I mean Emily Dickinson. The longer I live in Europe, the more American I become. I had a beef with the Beats, too loose for my tight britches. I was 40 nearly when I found Whitman waiting for me. I mean me. He told me so right there on Brooklyn Ferry. I let him in where Emily already had her attic room. His barbaric yop and her urgent whisper bred my voice. I had to get away to find out who is who. Here's another poem about music.
Do you think we could have the air?
Yes, let's have the air. Air is good. How's that?
Thank you.
Yeah, more air is good. Play. It isn't so much the shadows, though they move sometimes like lively script, when the wind rattles the branches of the beach, a tablature of loose melodic notes, a spray. It's more the lighted space between, I mean where choices make themselves, the slippage, so much like sex, opens a new way with an old tune. Where the laws bend and the constants prove inconstant, the cloud chamber fills up with subatomic pianos tuned to the key of pi. If I were God, I'd choose a bluesy key. Minor, something plangent, maybe Sabbath D. I'd use Miles Davis rasp to instruct the bass. Come in so after the beat. Eternity. Isn't it really just that long? One beat's moving along the bass line, elastic enough for both Miles and Glenn Moore. Let the shadows fall where they may. In the field of maybes, the wave function breaks into song. Strike it up in shades of blue. Sky, sea, lapis, Chicago, Memphis. Kansas City will always have a place in my heart, right in the center where the ear is. The whole reason we have this universe to begin with is only to play. Thank you. It's about the 4th of July. So the second section of this, this is still in Who's Who. This is a poem, a seasonal poem. It's called Blue Angels.
All right.
I mentioned Capaneus here. Capaneus was one of those classical dudes who got blasted by a bolt of lightning because he was defiant of the sky god. Where's my water? Excuse me. It's right here. Right here, Mom. The sky god. Blue Angels. They're tearing up the air above the house. That's what they're for. Reminding me of Eden's gate. Reminding me that I, for now, do not belong there. I rush out, shaking my fist like Capaneus. What do they care? Sheer abstraction, straining against mere limit, drag, and slog. The suburbs also raise their arms. But in salute, in praise, bring it down. Let it come down. Transform these tedious streets with fire. But me, this little locus here of will and memory and intellect, this sudden object shouting at the sky as though the screaming formulae above could feel my din, what dust of me would settle where if even once I caught their ballistic eye? Wow. That's a question. Thank you. The fourth section here is called Jones Among Friends. I had an old friend by the name of Randy Jones who died recently. He's a great artist. Great artist. He constructed things out of found objects in a way that's quite remarkable. And I stole his last name to replace mine because Jones, of course, is another word for an addiction. Mm-hmm. And these are poems about, this section is dominated by a poetic biography of a fictional poet by the name of Jones. The poem here is The Drunken Poet, a cultural type or trope. I've known my share. I became one myself. Socrates' motto, Knothi Sautan. Get to know is the verb. It doesn't point to the facts. It points to the process. So here's a couple of, thank you. Here's a couple of poems from this sequence. This one's called Jones First. The taste was hateful, like something from a swamp. A skunky reek, an irritating fizz. And that was just the beer. The much-prized booze went down like kerosene. Until the lamp went on, and in its light, the worried boy became the fearless man. And thereto he was light as air, untouchable, a thief of hearts, and all the simple world is only toy. Oh, he could speak and talk himself both in and out, a dazzler, with expertise to spare for all until A foggy daze enveloping his wit, he poured the gin into his lap and caroled darkness on the lawn and fumbled through the brambles till he bled and heard the cell door slam inside his head and woke in pain and jail, his dazzle gone. It's a long way down, and I won't take you all the way there. I'll skip right down to the bottom. This is called the bottom. A man at the end of his tether, a rope around his neck, standing alone on a chair, surrounded by air. Having come so far, why does he hesitate at this? It can't be simply fear. Fear brought him here. Where does he get the idea that this is not the end? Ideas he's already tried. Philosophers lied. Spinoza alone wrote what's true. But he couldn't get Jones down with his Euclid. At 45, he didn't get out alive. Was Spinoza really blessed as he ground the glass to dust, making lenses for others to use till he spit blood on his shoes? Nothing Jones knew or could name could reach into his despair. There was always another trap door to another, an emptier floor, till he came to the floor with his chair, where he found no farther to fall. And something that had no name, having also no use for blame, lifted the noose from his neck, brought his feet to the ground, forced him down on his knees, and taught him his first prayer. Please. And I'll read one more from the series. This is on the upswing. So brought you down, and now I don't want to leave you down there. Because that's not where it ends. That's really where it begins, which of course is a sequel. Jones enters the temple. The German state I live in is called Württemberg. Okay? That comes up. And it's famous like Scotland for its thrift. The Schwabs is what the local people are called. They're famous for their thrift and their orderliness. I married one. My life is always interesting. Jones enters the temple. Space is what he sees. Beams aslant of light. Nowhere is there furniture. An atmosphere draws high into the vaulted reach and dome. A man in robes sweeps, hush, the bare stone floor. Birdsong from beyond, swept dust among the slanting beams, odors, incense, beeswax, walls of darkness, brightest glass. The broom delivers here the lesson of the day. Hush, hush. Jones feels he knows this place, has been here once. He notices, does Jones. He stops and sees. The emptiness meets Benedict and bows in the dusted beams. The birds, the blackbirds sing. The singing rings like Spanish in Jones' ears. Spanish here in thrifty Württemberg. Vaya con Dios, tui. Vaya con Dios, tui. Jones sits in a carpet of light and feels his heart. The event tonight is followed, as ever, by an open mic. It's an opportunity for people to share their work. And I want to know where we are with the time now, because I don't want to impinge on that.
Take 10 minutes if you'd like.
Thank you. Okay, gladly. I'm going to go back here to the beginning of the book. The first section is called Mountain Wants Down to the Sea. I tried to climb Mount Rainier when I was 50. Didn't work. It was beautiful going up, and then the crest fogged up, and the mountain just, it turned against us. I stopped calling her it then and started calling her she. It was clear, no. So we went back down before we reached the summit. And the epigraph here is, I grew up under the mountain. We called her that, just as the tribes before ours did. Tohoma, mountain. They didn't need the article. She stands there nearly 3 miles high. I tried to climb her once. I wanted to see the valley where I came to consciousness from her peak. She clouded up as we neared the crest and blew us back. Thanks. So this poem is called Mountain Wants Down to the Sea. It's a long way to come to learn what we already know, that we do not belong here. Everything makes this clear. Crevasses deep beyond sight, blinding light from the ice face, tumbled gargantuan stones, the thin, ridiculous thread of our lives dragging in 40-foot lengths between us, the narrow, disorderly, switchbacking trail, the sky-filling, ice-covered mass over which we drag our wills upward. All of this warns us, your place is not here. Mountain herself wants down. Down to the sea. Away from the bastard files of the ice. Away from the wind's mad fellowship. Below us, her open veins. Below her, her open veins show the seaward road, where rills and creeks have braided themselves into silted rivers. The crashing of ice-broken stone from the bare, shattered ridge. The sudden thunder of avalanche half a mile off to the left. The winds whipping pellets of ice in our faces make clear. The will of the mountain is downward, seaward. And we, with our wills and our gear, not even an itch to scratch. Thank you. Thank you. I spent a lot of time with my dad as he was dying and wrote a lot of poems about it because that's what I do. And I want to read you, I guess, two of them. I end this poem with the term pas de deux. I don't want to lose you in the end. Pas de deux is a dance for two. It's a ballet term. Mm-hmm. And I think the point here is he upped his game at the end. Last dance. He'd always been an accomplished ballroom dancer, smooth and sure with any partner. How the ladies' pulses fluttered at his invitation. Men made room for him to cross the floor. Strange, as clumsiness had plagued his life, a false humility had drained his every other action of its proper joy. He'd never been quite easy in his skin. Yet Fred Astaire and he were of a kind. Hick gentlemen, hayseed sophisticates, they move with confidence in 3/4 time, as though for the duration of the number, life were fine. So when his life was nearly at an end, we knew, he knew, and weakness had depleted him, and pain and nausea, he had 3 days reprieve, 3 halcyon days. I drove him to the palliative clinic. On the way from car to radiologist, he did a little two-step shuffle at the curb, a bravura move, brief and expressive, his last pas de deux with cancer. I guess I'll read you exercise instead. I always had it. a beef with my old man. He never told me, actually, that he was proud of me. So I went to the master, whom I met in what we call the rooms. And the master told me what to do. This is called exercise. It was an exercise, like drawing freehand circles or shaving curls of white pine with a new honed plane. Not something undertaken for its own sake, not a work of art or a vow, just a little practice in the science of the heart. I didn't mean the words. I'd been told to speak. I'm new to human life, a green apprentice doing what I'm told. The master told me, what you always lacked is what you have to give. He deals in paradox. And so, because the dying man had never said to me, I'm proud of you, that's what I said to him. And doing so, discovered I had never meant one thing I said before as I meant this. And what is more, redounding from his silence came this sense. He felt the same. You know, it's a great privilege to be here, to have the opportunity to do this stuff in your presence. And I have a lot of people to thank for it. Of course, Chris here, who keeps open this shop in an atmosphere that's not friendly to small bookstores. We all know this. We can all acknowledge that by bringing our custom to stores like this. Phoebe, who from afar, here I am, I'm in the Black Forest, and I haven't been in Seattle in ages. Nobody knows me. And Phoebe's telling me, well, this is a hard place to find a reading. And sure enough, on the other side of the lake, I couldn't find a bookstore that was really open to this, because they don't know if they're going to be where they are 1 month to the next. And Phoebe came here and talked to Chris and made this opening for me. And I'm extremely grateful for that. Phoebe's been a tireless advocate of the literary arts, both spoken and written, for the 40 years I've known her. Yeah. And her press,
Raven Chronicles books, put out a lot of handsome books. Here's one. It's an anthology of work that she's published along with her fellow editor, Kathleen Alcala, and I believe Phil Red Eagle's still involved.
So there's lots to be proud of. The poetry survives not just because people have an itch to write, but because people have a desire to hold spaces where it can blossom out and share itself. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful. And there too, oh gosh, there's so many people to thank. I have to thank my local host, who's left now, Gulia, who's putting me up. Everywhere along this trip, from all the way from Nashville to here, I've encountered extraordinary hospitality. And despite all the things that are wrong with the country right now, there are so many people doing the right thing by one another and teaching what I believe is the lesson of the Odyssey. It's all about hospitality. That dude, he depended upon it. Where he didn't find it, well, he got his revenge. Gosh. Maybe I'll do two more poems. I'm going to lighten up a little bit here. You might have heard from the Zen Buddhist tradition the saying that if you meet the Buddha on the road, you should kill him. Heard that? You might wonder why. Well, this poem attempts to give a sketch of why you might want to do that. It's called I Met the Buddha on the Road. And I'm going to take a sip before I do it. I met the Buddha on the road. I knew him by the light. It played like music at his lips and eyes. Awakened one, I cried. He yawned. I do desire to be desireless. You'll get over it, he said. No, really, I replied. I seek a quiet mind. He said, shut up. Ha ha, I said, I'll follow you wherever you may go. He said, I'm going to go to sleep. And did. He snored. I grew bored. Persistent flies buzzed at my lips and eyes until I cried, Buddha Smuda, enlighten my sweet ass. He said, well, now you're talking. I just gave this, I facilitated a workshop, which was a lot of fun, with people who are just like me. They come, they're inspired, they have lines that occur to them, and they need to invent context in which those lines can blossom out and become something that's worth sharing. And this poem is a manifestation of that. Years ago, when I was walking along, I used to live back in Leschi, way down Leschi, and I think it was like 81. And I'm walking along the lake, and I stand still, and I notice all these masts are doing this. And I didn't see it when I was moving. And then I started doing this with trees. And I noticed the stiller I stand, the more trees move. I must have worked that into four or five different poems, and the one that I came up with is this one. It's called Poem, which means made thing. The stiller I stand, the more trees move, each after its art. Aspen quivers, willow waves, spruce paws, the oak conducts. Their motions move in me toward silence, where a rustle from beyond time whispers this. If I am to find you, pilgrim, it is only in this standing place and only in this rich, bare moment, stripped of fear and hope, bereft of remorse and longing. Now, as the world is ending, as it is always ending, as it never ends, here in the fine web of your tender nerves, here in the vast sweep of the bottomless sky, here on this forest edge in the mending light, you with these others, I am.